Welcome to the Common Good Podcast, a conversation about the significance of place, eliminating economic isolation, and the structure of belonging. This is Joey Taylor, the producer of the podcast, and on this episode, we conclude the conversation about Greg Jarrell's new book, Our Trespasses, White Churches and the Taking of American Neighborhoods. If you haven't listened to the first part of the conversation, it's probably best to press pause and come back to this episode after you've finished. In this episode, Don Anthony and Troy Kahn kick us off with a song before our facilitator Courtney Napier invites Greg to read an excerpt from his book. In this reading, he references a painting called The Gleaners, which is the cover art for this episode. Here's Don and Troy.
Give me a bottle of justice. I'll take that bottle of justice. I hear it sets you free. You can be just who you want to be. I think I'll have some of that. Wrap it up real nice for me, please. Give me a box of reparations. Yes, I'll take that box of reparations. The little one, I want the big one that matches my scars. It's such a pretty thing, something I have needed since I came here from afar, so very far. I think I'll have some of that.
If you weren't moving in your seat, check your pulse a little bit. That was stunning, Don and Troy. Thank you so much. Greg, I would love to invite you to read another excerpt from your book.
So the quick setup here, I've tracked this family, the Norths. The ancestors are Abram and Annie. And there is a portrait that is the single artifact that I can find from their house that they bought in 1893 or so. And it is a print of this French painting from Second Empire France in the 1850s or so that's called The Gleaners. So here's a little piece from there. There's a single artifact remaining from the North House at 625 East 2nd Street. It is a framed black and white print of Jean-Francois Miget's The Gleaners, housed in the history room at Clinton Chapel AME Zion Church. In the painting, three women are gathering the leftover grain heads from a field. The field has already been cut and the prime of the harvest taken. The three peasants are picking up what was left behind. Behind the women are towers of golden straw in groups of three, a distressing sign of abundance amid poverty. The harvest of the field is plentiful. It is in view. It is not available to the gleaners. The distance between the gleaners and the rest of the community behind them emphasizes the separation of those who are poor from the rest of their society. In the background, more than 20 figures are building gilded towers on a large farm. An overseer on horseback enforces their separation. The gleaners are far removed from that community, as Millet's composition makes clear, and yet they are the focus of the canvas, painted large and in careful detail. The Gleaners portrays no unity between landowner and gleaner, no social divides being bridged during a rest break in the shade. There are three women, hunched. They are exhausted. Their harvest is slim. The sun beats from above. They bend down and then stand. They bend down again. But remarkably, they are the subjects. They have their full measure of dignity, if not of grain. When Millet presented the Gleaners at the 1857 Salon in Paris, it was judged a political provocation. During that era of French life, poor people and workers were frozen out of land ownership, their opportunities limited in service of greed and power. The challenge of seeing poor people drawn large, placed in the center, the focus of extended meditation, was more than the salon goers of Second Empire France could handle. Millet fetched a distressingly low price for the painting. In time, it would become one of the best-known pieces of 19th-century European art. The reaction of the French ruling class to the painting described Charlotte, where the visibility of those who were poor was an offense to good taste, and still is. Those in the elite do not spend decade after decade moving those who are oppressed from place to place, only to have to see them. Abram and Annie North left no written record of why they purchased the print of the Gleaners, or why they carefully framed it, or why they left it to their church as part of their legacy. Perhaps the North saw themselves in it. Maybe they saw themselves freed from it. Perhaps they saw themselves in it, then freed from it, and then placed back in it. The painting certainly described their city, where towers of gold stood in plain sight, yet were rendered inaccessible by mounted surveillance or by rules and customs that consigned some people always to the edges. The Norths were not the only Black family who saw something in Millet's work. The childhood home of Martin Luther King Jr. in Atlanta had a print of the painting in the living room as well. There they were, Abram and Annie, part of the city, yet kept apart from it, inside the story of Charlotte, but held on the outside of it, beloved and respected, but always from a distance, always at arm's length, hiding at the edges of the historical record where they might one day be seen, where perhaps some sense of justice might finally come to be, however proximate. They haunt still, as do those who were silenced, who have been silenced, who are silenced. They return, they are returning, they will return, and there are always more with them, holding the future in their hands until the plunder of the past is resolved.
I'm inviting you all now to share your incredible insights and the things that you highlighted in your groups. But I would love for us to reflect on this idea of maps as theology, maps as a political statement. And Dr. Shaniqua Walker Barnes wrote the incredible foreword for Our Trespasses. And this quote will be the prompt for the conversation to follow, facilitated by you all. And it is, "The story of Brooklyn community shows us the power of whiteness to literally move an entire neighborhood. If that can be done in the name of injustice, surely it can be done in the name of justice." We'd love to hear your thoughts right now about maps, maps as theology, and remaking our communities in the name of justice, your communities in the name of justice. Yes, Daniel.
So I have a question, but what keeps coming up for me is the question around belonging. And I've been struggling with that notion of belonging. And when I look at the map, I'm like, do people actually belong to community? And if so, does that come from a colonizer mindset? The notion of belonging feels possessive. You belong to me. I don't have an answer. It's more of a question because there's something about belonging that doesn't quite feel right. But I keep feeling it as we're talking about neighborhood and who belongs and who doesn't and where do they belong. So I don't know if that has to do with maps or not, but that's kind of what's stirring up for me right now.
That's powerful. Greg, is anything coming up for you with that question?
That's a really good question. It's a sort of about power, maybe. I hear Daniel, like, who has the power to define what belongs where? And part of what I was trying to track here was maybe you could frame in terms of belonging as to, like, who gets to determine who belongs where, right? In physical space, and also the nature of a community. So a significant portion of this project, and I didn't get to read from it today because we just don't have time, was looking inside the white churches whose members made this to happen, who planned and executed and profited from urban renewal, who said literally, like, this space belongs to us. We know how to use it better than your community does. So I think that is a really insightful question. And not only do we need some material repair for the families that were harmed, but we need the kind of cultural repair that would help white churches and white ministers like me to be able to have a definition of belonging that can serve us and serve our cities well, rather than being possessive. That's really insightful.
I love that. Daniel, I'd love to maybe turn your question back to you now that you've heard from Greg. How do you see belonging at work in the framework that we've developed to generate justice, as opposed to in the past being somewhat of a barrier or a boundary keeping justice from happening?
It is definitely a question of power and who has power and who gets to determine the boundaries. Greg's response has me now thinking about whether or not maybe there's belonging in a smaller group of people. Like, I believe there's belonging in the household, but I feel like maybe there's more justice for the community or the neighborhood. Like, that's the practice. Belonging is in a much smaller circle of relationships. And as you broaden out justice or some other kind of practice, that's what I'm thinking right now. So I think that maybe there's a place for it. I'm just not sure. I haven't worked it all out.
Dwight, what would you like to share, and how have these thoughts possibly shaped or redirected your thoughts?
Yeah, when Daniel asked the question about belonging, it made me think, I mean, one of the weapons of colonization was to disrupt belonging, to break the bond that we had with the land, to break the bond that we had with one another, to make the social fabric weak. And so it took me back to Greg's work. And I mean, in a lot of ways, I think the ghosts that haunt is the absence of belonging when the settlers have moved in and set up shop. And yet something of what haunts the settler, I think, is the reality that their abstracted existence there, it seems to call to them in the hallways at night. And I wonder if part of the work that I'm seeing in and through Greg's book and is like, what does it look like now to almost like demystify the ghosts and almost learn to listen to them as wise ancestors instead of being haunted by them as something that we want to deny the existence of?
I love what you're saying, Dwight. I think the part of what kept kind of confronting me in the research for this was the real deep brokenness is sort of sounds a little bit cliche, but inside the white communities that I was working with around this history, they didn't know about themselves and about their own institution. If we're not going to live inside the truth of what actually happened, then we can't be healed from it. And so there was this real sense of the shallowness of the spirituality of the community that existed in there and their ability to develop any sense of community with the larger city or the neighborhoods because of the shallowness of what they were dealing with, this sense of being haunted and not knowing how to move from it, how to be healed from it.
Yes. I also would love to introduce this idea of maybe environment and like a natural thing that belonging is that can be disturbed by this idea of possession and dispossession, how belonging is also an action. Belonging feels very active. It feels like reciprocity. It feels like respect. It feels like listening and seeing yourself as not unlike the other, as a part of, inextricably linked to another. And how possession and dispossession disturb that concept entirely in my mind. So, Daniel, thank you for kind of cracking this open and cracking this idea of belonging open. Darren, I'd love to bring you to the floor for your thoughts.
Thank you, Courtney. I'm going to go in a slightly different direction away from the belonging and think about the significance of place. And thinking on our recent conversation with John Powell and how you posed the question around structure, could you weave together a little bit like why that photo for you is so important?
I mean, so there's a personal story for sure. For the past 20 years, I've lived in a neighborhood in Charlotte where the people who had to flee that bulldozer moved to the neighborhood that I'm in now. And over the past 2 or 3 years, the bulldozers have started showing up again, both figuratively and literally. I think part of the struggle, like, so places always change, but the way that particularly monetizing, commodifying every single piece of soil inside the cities that we live in really disrupts the way that people build life together within those spaces. In some ways, we've kind of seen our neighborhood hollowed out and sort of had its vivaciousness taken away because, you know, money, because it was a useful commodity now rather than a disinvested, forgotten kind of commodity that was outside the boundaries. Now it was inside and it was open to a new form of exploitation. There's John.
When you were leading the reflection on the painting and you were reading and unpacking it, the thing that really stood out to me was just the separateness from the gleaners in the foreground and then that whole activity in the background. And I think one of the questions I'm noticing, and I'm joining from the Mission District of San Francisco, and we have a lot of diverse communities here, but there's often a lack of knowing each other and lack of bridges. And I saw that in that photo. There seemed to be a lack of one community intimately knowing the other. And I'm just wondering, like, is what we see in Charlotte and so many other places inevitable when there's not the knowing, there's not the bridging of community, there's not the sharing stories and sharing culture and sharing lives with each other? Is that what we should expect? And if so, like, how do we foster friendships among people of different social, economic, racial, lifestyle communities?
Yeah, I mean, it's a complicated question. But to me, what I keep coming back to is about the physical nature of how space reinforces distance and potentially can then to help bridge distance. When we have the spaces to gather, when we have the kinds of neighborhoods or urban environments or towns that can help people to rub shoulders together, at least. And certainly being together doesn't solve the issues of the unequal distribution of power, of resources. But it does suggest a different kind of way that we might interact together, whereas the racialization of space and the spatialization of race that so dominates our cities seems to push us in a different direction that makes it hard to develop the kinds of relationships you're talking about.
I love that. And I love the idea of not so much changing minds, but engaging minds, this idea of engaging those who may not have yet to identify with the oppressed, nor have they identified with the oppressor. They're kind of in this middle space and engaging them with those stories and maybe power that's there. Rachel, I'd love to hear your thoughts.
So I'm Rachel. I am in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And I think, Greg, what you just shared, I had shared in our breakout a picture of the park behind my house in the city. And last week, it was unusually warm in Michigan. And I had taken the picture just before signing up to join you all. And there were so many people out. And our park brings together the most diverse group of people, I think, in the city often. Like, we have basketball courts and futsal and disc golf and playgrounds and a volleyball court and a community center and gym. And then I was sharing what was on the outside of the park, which we didn't see in the shot, was we've also had a lot of gun violence in our neighborhood recently as well, and deaths. So it's often, I think, this holding both the paradox of pain and possibility, right? Acknowledging like the pain that exists within our community, you know, thinking about urban renewal and how it affects my community. There was a huge freeway that was put through the middle of the city and kind of divided in our neighborhood at one point from it had been a real thriving economic hub, and that freeway then brought people to the suburbs and would be identified as the blighted. If HUD was going to define it, it would be blighted. Yet there is really beautiful community there and people. And so that relational connection, I think, too, is a huge piece of how systemic change happens, is always holding both of those spaces of how do we repair injustice and create systemic justice and policy and practice, and also build spaces that bring people together for connectedness and relationship. I'm just thinking, Greg, of your book is like the church in this case wasn't that place, but people didn't even realize, right, what they were doing and how we have to kind of reimagine spaces too, so that they become places that seek and reimagine justice as well. And I had the privilege of being in a space yesterday where we did that with the community and kind of did World Cafe, if you've ever done that, about talking about connectedness and building them. And it was multi-sector and young and old people. And so I hold out possibility we can do that, even in places where often the pain is very, very real.
Thank you so much, Rachel. Thank you. And thank you, Dwight. And I want to just especially shout out you. You shared so many great things, Daniel, Darren, John, and of course, Greg. Thank you so, so much for inviting us into this conversation about your book. And please go out and buy it. Where can we find it? Yeah, please tell us, where can we find it and buy a copy?
Our Trespasses, you can find it wherever you find books, especially at your local bookstore. They can access it relatively easily, but you can use the big national giants as well to get a copy. And certainly let me know how you're engaging with it. A big thank you to my dear friends, Dawn, Anthony, and Troy Kahn, who are just across town right now. Thanks for being here.
And thank you, Dawn and Troy, for playing us out. Thank you, everybody, for coming. We appreciate you so much.
Thanks so much. Some of you may know this song if you've been on your feet and being more than just at your desks, but on your feet and supporting the causes of the people. So if you're muted on your end, the tagline at the end is far too long, and we won't be silent anymore. Oh, somebody's hurting my brother, and it's gone on far too long. I tell you, it's gone on far too long. I tell you, it's gone on far too long. Oh, somebody's hurting my brother, and it's gone on far too long, and we won't be silent anymore. Did you hear somebody's hurt my sister, and it's gone on far too long? I tell you, it's gone on far too long. I tell you, it's gone on far too long. Yeah, somebody's hurt my sister, and it's gone on far too long, and we won't be silent anymore. Did you know somebody's hurt the children, and it's gone on far too long? Yes, it's gone on far too long. I tell you, it's gone on far too long. Somebody's hurt the children, and it's gone on far too long, and we won't be silent anymore. Last one, did you know somebody's hurting the families? Somebody's hurting our families, and it's gone on far too long. Yes, it's gone on far too long. I tell you, it's gone on far too long. Somebody's hurting our families, and it's gone on far too long, and we won't be silent anymore. We won't be silent anymore. Come on, y'all. And we won't be silent anymore. Last time, we won't be silent. And we won't be silent anymore.
Thanks for listening. Check the show notes for more information about the book. Courtney, Daniel, Dwight, John, Rachel, and of course, Don and Troy. This episode has been produced by me, Joey Taylor, and the bumper music is from Jeff Gorman.